From WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, this is Johannes Werner with your WSLR News headlines for Wednesday, October 16th. Recovery from Hurricane Milton is continuing quickly. The Siesta Key and Casey Key areas now have water service restored, except Fisherman's Haven and Sanderling Road. The boil water notice for Casey Key and Siesta Key has been lifted. Some properties that are served by a master meter have been isolated because of leaks. The Disaster Recovery Center in Sarasota County has relocated from South Sarasota to downtown and opened Monday at the Sarasota Municipal Auditorium at 801 North Tamiami Trail. Hours are 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. daily. This site has FEMA representatives available in person to assist with applications and answer questions. The Disaster Recovery Center was swamped yesterday. By lunchtime, waits for residents to register with FEMA were 4 or 5 hours long. So security began turning people away at the door and encouraged them to return another time. Applications can also be made online at disasterassistance.gov. Meanwhile, Citizens Property Insurance staff is available at a site off Fruitville Road near I-75. That's at Osprey Commerce Center behind Applebee's at 100 Paramount Drive. That location is open from 9 to 5. The National Hurricane Center is tracking two disturbances, one with a growing chance of developing and approaching the Caribbean this week, and another that is forming in the Caribbean. As of Tuesday evening, forecasters increased the chances of both the Atlantic and Caribbean system strengthening into a tropical depression in the next 2 days to 40%. The Atlantic system could approach the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico by Thursday or Friday. The Caribbean system near the coast of Honduras poses a threat mainly to Central America. This has been Johannes Werner with your WSLR News headlines for Wednesday, October 16th.
Welcome to the Peace and Justice Report. I'm Tom Walker. We're here live every Wednesday morning from 9 until 10. Bob Connors and I alternate the weeks. Alvaro is here in the studio this morning. Good morning, Alvaro.
Good morning.
Oh, good morning. The opinions you hear on this show are our own or those of our guests and not necessarily those of WSLR's board, its employees, or volunteers. As Johannes was talking about, a lot of us had flooding and other damage during Milton. I hope everybody's doing fine. If you were impacted by the hurricane, you can apply for FEMA disaster assistance up until December 11th. If you completed an application for involving Hurricane Debbie or Helene, you need to complete a separate application for Milton in one of three ways. You can go to disasterassistance.gov. You can use the FEMA phone app, or you can call 800-621-3362. And in Sarasota and Manatee counties, you can call 311 for non-emergency outage tips and questions. By the way, the Disaster Recovery Center has opened up at the Sarasota Municipal Auditorium, 801 North Tamiami Trail. That's the one with the round roof. The hours are 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. each day. Finally, there's an operation called Operation Bluetooth. Blue Roof. This program is a free service for homeowners and permanently occupied rental properties, providing fiber-reinforced industrial strength sheeting to protect storm-damaged roofs and until homeowners can make permanent requires. Residents can sign up by going to blueroof.gov. Our guest today is Bob Creamer. Bob, are you on the line?
I am on the line.
That's great. Welcome, Bob. His new book is Nuts and Bolts, the Formula for Progressive Electoral Success. In it, Bob explains how to design and execute successful campaigns. He's had over five decades of progressive activism as a political organizer and strategist. Bob cut his organizing teeth with Saul Alinsky, famous name. His last campaign in Chicago in the 1970s. He then founded Illinois Public Action, which grew to become the state's largest public interest coalition under his 23-year direction. And then in 2011, Bob founded Democracy Partners, which is still going on, a political consulting firm that guides progressive campaigns across the country. Over his career, Bob has worked with hundreds of electoral and issue campaigns at the local, state, and national level. During the Obama administration, for instance, he worked closely with the White House to pass the Affordable Care Act, to increase minimum wage, to enact comprehensive immigration reform, pass legislation to stem gun violence, and gain confirmation for President Obama's nominations to the Supreme Court. He was also one of the architects of the successful campaign to defeat President Bush's plan to privatize Social Security. We're going to talk about that. He has written regular columns for such publications as the Huffington Post and USA Today. He's the husband of Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky, the representative for Illinois' 9th Congressional District. So, and you can see his Wikipedia information for much more. So welcome, Bob Creamer. You've had a hell of a...
Good to be with you.
Yes.
I think the thing that I want to say before anything else is the number one priority for everyone, certainly outside of Sarasota, is to try and make sure that you all get the help you need to make sure you get recovered. What a horrible tragedy for so many people I know. And getting everybody recovery money and FEMA doing their job is so important. So,
yes.
I just want to offer my best wishes and hope that everybody's standing up for you guys in this time.
Yeah, I think we're doing good. We appreciate FEMA, and I think we're recovering. We escaped a could have been a more serious blow. Went right over my house. I had the eye of the storm for an hour, just perfectly still outside. It's very strange, but it could have been worse. So, Bob, tell us a little bit about your career. Take us through the career and the highlights of your career, just to set the stage.
Well, I grew up in Shreveport, Louisiana, and I was involved in the civil rights movement, kind of part of high school, and then I went away to college to Duke. And in 1968, Martin Luther King was killed, as everybody knows, and a lot of student activists organized to do something. And we went to, we marched to the president of the university's house. He was a pretty liberal guy, but he made a speech, and then we said, well, Mr. President, we're not leaving until you meet some demands. Recognize the non-academic employees union. It was predominantly black, and the janitors and the maids and people worked in the dining halls, and raise their salaries to a reasonable level. More reasonable level. It was awful at the time. And resigned from the All White Country Club. And so we had to sit in there for a couple of days. He didn't have us arrested or anything. The press was covering it. And pretty soon comes the head of student activities who says, you know, the president of the university has had some kind of a mental thing, you know, a breakdown. Right? He's got to take a vacation. So the vice president of Ford Motor Company, who's the chairman of the board of trustees, he's coming to run the place for a little while. And we thought, well, he may treat us differently. So we marched to the quadrangle of the university and started a silent vigil at Duke. And pretty soon there were 200 of us to start. There were a couple thousand.
Amazing.
And then comes then the non-academic employees union went on strike. And the bunch of the faculty went on strike. And 4 days later, we won. And, you know, I said, well, my goodness. This kind of organizing really works. You could do this for a lifetime. So that's what started me on this road, and I've been doing that kind of thing ever since.
You had one victory. I remember with the Chicago Crosstown Expressway. How did you do that? What method did you use to win that victory?
My goodness, Tom, I'm amazed you remember that. That was a while back. Well, Mayor Daley in Chicago is going to build an expressway that would have just... displaced 30,000 homes and 10,000 businesses down the west side of Chicago. And our view was not only that was a terrible idea, but beyond that, it would create a lot of pollution, and the money should be put into mass transit. So So we organized a campaign. It was one of the first biracial campaigns because it affected various communities of different races. Chicago was fairly polarized at the time. And really went at it and had demonstrations and actions every day, or I mean, not every day, but every week or so. We'd have actions that got press coverage. And pretty soon there was going to be an election, and the candidate for governor, the Democratic candidate for governor, Dan Walker, agreed with us. He sided with us and said he would veto it if he was elected. So we organized a voter information campaign all down the corridor of the expressway that he was the guy who could stop this highway. And he won by a very narrow margin, credited us in many ways with his victory, and declared that the Crosstown Expressway was dead, and the money was transferred to mass transit, and the extension of a variety of subway lines in Chicago, and that's what happened.
Huh. And you've been doing it ever since, and you started Democracy Partners, which consults, I guess, with lots of different groups. We can talk about that work later, but let's talk about your book. It's called Nuts and Bolts, and it really is. I've read, maybe a tenth of it, 60 pages. It's really well written, and every page has something useful or suggestion or three or four that you can act on. But anyways, Nuts and Bolts, the formula for progressive electoral success. Tell us a little bit more about it, about the book. How is it organized, and what will we find in it?
Well, you know, it starts off by talking about the great Green Bay Packer coach Vince Lombardi, you know, who's one of the greatest coaches ever and had some of the best teams ever. And he'd start every season by bringing everybody into the locker room, picking up a football and say, gentlemen, this is a football.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to focus on the blocking and tackling, the nuts and bolts of what we're trying to do. And that's the way we've got to do it if we want to win elections. And the blocking and tackling of politics is understanding self-interest, the self-interest of the voters, in very concrete ways, and understanding that self-interest is not just about economics, although that's very, very important. It's also about questions like the need people have for freedom of their own lives,
mm-hmm.
the need people have for a sense of meaning in life, which is so important. One of the things that Trump has done is to capitalize on the fact that there's a big chunk of the population of America who feels like they're left behind.
Yeah.
That and disrespected by the so-called elites. And, boy, there's nothing like being disrespected to turn people off, because people want to feel like they have meaning in life more than anything else. And we've got to understand it, and meaning in life is about feeling like you could be part of something bigger than yourself and make a meaningful contribution to that goal. And in all of our political communications and political action, we have to be focused on that understanding.
So what makes a great campaign? Go into that a little further. What makes a great organizer?
Sure. Well, let me take them separately. The First off, campaigns are about changing the behavior of the voters. If we weren't changing the behavior of the voters, we might as well all go to the beach, right? They're going to do the same thing that they would before. And there are only two groups of people in an electoral context that can be changed, whose behavior can be changed. One is people who are persuadables. That is to say, they're likely to vote, but they're undecided. They're switch hitters. And this election coming up, there's a group of those. A bunch of them are people who are sometimes have voted Republican, might think of themselves as Republican, but understand for one reason or the other that Trump really jeopardizes the democracy. And it's, you don't become a Democrat just because you vote Democratic. You're standing up for the country to avoid this kind of tragedy that would be if Trump won. Anyway, they're persuadables. Second group of people are mobilizables. Those are people who'd be likely to vote for our candidate, but they're unlikely to vote unless we mobilize them. And there the focus of attention is not so much the candidate, which it is in the case of persuadable. It's the voter here, him or herself. I mean, what motivates you to get off the couch? That's the issue. And there are a lot of things, but the messages that work the best, there are about 13 or 14 I list in the book, but are inspiration, people feeling like they could be part of something bigger than themselves and themselves play a significant role, and hope at that same time. You got to hope if you're going to get people to vote, not just fear. Fear immobilizes. Hope energizes. The other is, I won't get off your porch or phone until you vote. You know? The old, plain old mechanical, I'm showing up and paying attention message. And that works. I mean, we know empirical evidence that really works. That's why it's so important to be knocking on doors now and making phone calls and going out and talking to people personally. I mean, COVID created this notion you can kind of reintroduce the notion that TV, or in this case the internet, is the new precinct cabinet. No, people are. Relationships are what great campaigns are about. And so we got to focus on those two groups. And we got to remember one thing. If there's anything in this book I want people to remember, it's the fundamental feature of political communication that's most important. Comes from Maya Angelou.
Mm-hmm.
She says, I've learned that people will forget what you said, people will forget what you did, but people will never forget how you made them feel.
Mm.
I mean, our job is to make people feel good about themselves. Mm. I mean, not, you know, it's just like a personal relationship or a love affair or whatever. And when it comes to persuadable voters, you're not trying to convince them that you're the greatest. You're trying to convince them in your presence, with your leadership or whatever. They feel good about themselves.
Mm.
That's why berating people is not going to do the job.
Mm.
What will do the job is inspiring people.
Mm. All right, so let's say I'm on the front porch, and how do I inspire a voter or make them feel good about themselves? Good enough maybe to vote for your candidate.
Well, depends on the... I mean, there are a variety of qualities that candidates evince that help do that. I mean, one is, of course, you got to convince them that you're on their side.
Yeah.
And that's a threshold question of politics. Who's on my side? And you can do that by the battles you fought in particular.
Yeah.
Or the battles you fight with them together.
Yeah.
I mean, who's on your side is most critical in persuasion. And the inspiring them is about, as much as anything, putting people in motion, making people feel. You convince people more by putting them in motion.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody goes to cheer for a candidate at a rally, they're much more likely to vote for them than if you sit there in your living room, trying to convince them half the day. Because it involves their emotion, it involves their feelings. It involves their feeling they can do something. I mean, if you get them to put up a yard sign even, and you get them to host a coffee for you, and then they think they're doing something for this that matters, then they can, you know, that's how you get people really passionately convinced about campaigns.
One time I was at a PERG training up in Boston about 20, 25 years ago, and they told us not only to have an elevator speech, of course, which is really quickly explaining what you are and about, but they told us to tell three stories: the story of me, the story of us, and the story of now. Story of me, of course, is your personal experience, make people relate to you. Story of us, yep, is about why this organization exists and what we've been doing, great work we've been doing. But the story of now is the current threat to whatever we're talking about, the urgency, and that's the one you end with, and to convince them that they need to act, and that just we practice those stories, and I'm sure all good organizers have techniques to inspire people. So,
yeah, that's great. That's a great formulation. I like that a lot. The other thing is, I mean, great organizers spend a whole lot of time listening and asking questions.
Oh, yeah.
Not talking, not telling, but asking. And because, as you say, you start talking to people and getting them to tell you what they feel and what their concerns are, their automatic understanding is that you're on their side. I mean, empathy is an extraordinarily important quality in both candidates and organizers. I mean, you know, old Donald Trump, when the good Lord passed out empathy, he went around that day. He skipped school, you know, because he didn't have any. But great organizers do, and they and that's communicated as much as anything through asking than it is through telling. That's a really important lesson in great organizing.
You know, on page 35 of your book, you talked about persuadables, and you said these are people who are likely to vote, but who are switch hitters in any given election. They generally vote, but they vote for a Republican in one election and a Democrat in the next. Now, my question, of course, is on the voter rolls. It shows whether you voted, and we'll get to that later, but it doesn't show who you voted for, of course. So how do we find...
Well, we have secret ballots, but there are a variety of ways to determine who's got good odds of being a persuadable.
Uh-huh.
I mean, and by the way, many of those are translated into codes on voter files.
Yeah.
I mean, the voter files that a lot of campaigns use have two codes on them. One is a percentage odds of your voting. Mm-hmm. The other is a percentage odds of your voting Democratic.
Mm-hmm.
But those come from a variety of analytics. I mean, one is where you live. You know, you have secret ballots for individuals, but in a precinct, you know, we know what the percentage of votes for Democrats and Republicans are. So if you live there and we don't know anything else about you, mm-hmm. what we do know is that it says you're a 70%
gotcha.
Democratic precinct, you have 70% odds of being Democratic
just
by being living there. We know from various demographics what people are likely to do. I mean, you know, African American voters are some of the smartest voters in America. They tend to vote Democratic.
That's right.
Because it's in their interest. Various demographic groups are equally divided. The white men have a tendency generally more to vote Republican, unless they're a union member,
mm-hmm.
in which case they have a tendency to vote Democratic. And showing the power of organization. All that data translates, and then if you vote only in general elections, then you're much more likely to be a persuadable. If you vote in a Democratic primary or Republican primary, the odds are really good you're going to vote Democrat or Republican in the general election.
Right.
So there's a whole swath of people who can be categorized that way. And then, of course, we have voter registration in various states. A lot of states have voter registration, but you register as a Republican or Democrat, whereas in some states you don't. But where you do, that's another piece of data that can figure into an understanding of whether somebody's a persuadable or not. Now, when you get to those people who are Democrats already on the voter file, the question is, which of those people are mobilizable? Well, people who are not likely to vote.
Yeah.
If somebody hadn't voted, you know, 30% of the time, 40% of the time, then we know that they should be mobilized. They have a heavy target for mobilization. The best campaigns are not leaving any stone unturned.
They're
talking to everyone who is a likely voter. In fact, the best campaigns can be thought of as treasure hunts. They are, our job is to, first off, figure out what is a winning number of voters. And then the job of the campaign is to find that many voters who we believe will vote for our candidate and get them out. And some of those may be imputed by their codes and all that kind of stuff. Some of that data comes from asking.
Yeah.
That's why we do a canvas. We ask people through early stages of the campaign, who are they going to vote for? They're going to vote for our guy? If they say they're going to vote for our candidate, odds are pretty good they're going to. They say they're going to vote against us, if we've already identified ourselves as a partisan advocate, then we can be pretty sure they're not. If they say they're undecided, we should take them at their word. And and we put them all in a file, and in the end, Election Day, our goal is to have a list of the names of the people who we believe will vote for us if we just get them out. And then our job over the course of the lead up to the election is to get them to the polls.
By the way, one question I had, we know who did not vote in the last election or the last primary, and are they, do you think of a postcard saying, you didn't vote last time, we hope you do this time? Have you ever seen that tried, and would it work, or would it offend people?
No, that helps.
It helps?
When people find out that it is public information whether they vote,
yeah,
they're more likely to go do it. And the reason is, and this is a huge hugely important lesson in politics in general, social proof.
Uh-huh.
Social proof to people is hugely important in politics and in all human behavior, because human beings are pack animals. You know, we all travel in packs.
Yeah.
We like to be with the group. And if you don't know much about anybody, and you see your neighbors are supporting somebody, either through postcards or through yard signs or whatever. I mean, I know people who live in areas they think are really Republican, and suddenly, if there's a whole bunch of Democratic yard signs, they say, "Well, look here, a bunch of my neighbors really support this person. Maybe it's okay for me to, too."
Hmm. We're talking to Bob Creamer. His new book is called Nuts and Bolts, and it really is Nuts and Bolts, the formula for progressive electoral success. While we're talking about elections, do you want to make a prediction as to who will win in November?
Well, my prediction is that we can make the difference. This is not just about what Kamala Harris does, not just about what Waltz does, not just about what Trump does and so on, and Vance, God love him. It's about what we all do. We can make the difference between, because it's not just, you know, these polls, a lot of them show very short, very close.
Yeah.
I believe they are underestimating the degree of our support as they have in 2020 and 22, because 2018, because they're looking at the margin of error, not the margin of effort.
I like that.
I'll give you an example. New York, in the 3rd Congressional District of New York, that was the Tom Suozzi race, to remember to replace that guy Santos, who was so weird when he resigned.
Mm-hmm.
The New York Times Siena poll had it even the weekend before the election in the polling. Their assumption, of course, was that it would be 50% voter turnout among Republican registrants and 50% among Democrats. They ignored the fact that Democrats had done 300,000 phone calls and 150,000 door knocks. We had an 8% advantage to them in terms of turnout, and we won by 8 points. What a shock. And that's going to happen, I hope, this time, because our ground game is extremely superior to theirs. We've got people going door to door all over in the swing states, and we've got people, like right here in Illinois, we have Operation Swing State that sends hundreds of people to Michigan and Wisconsin every weekend, both days, to canvass.
Great.
Well, in Florida, it is a swing state.
Oh.
And I know that everybody's burdened by this awful hurricane destruction. But to the extent we can, we got to be focusing on our neighbors and getting them to vote. And that will make the difference. Who turns out? This is a turnout election.
Last week, the New York Times reported that last week, the Harris campaign it knocked on over 600,000 doors, I guess, in 1 week, and 3 million calls through 63,000 volunteer shifts. So, yeah, they're working. They're working the way you said they should.
Now, Kamala, when she took over as the candidate, she inherited a field operation that had been set up by the Biden campaign over a period of many months. There were 270 offices in the 7 swing states and already about 1,200 organizers on the ground. And there are a lot more now, but they were able to absorb this huge influx of volunteers that resulted from the enthusiasm of her candidacy. Mm-hmm. And that's a big, big plus. I got to say, I think in Florida, we have, of course, the referendum on freedom of reproductive choice, which is so important to so many people.
Yep.
You know, it's a lot easier to organize around things people try and take away from it than things that you aspire to. And you know, Trump reached out from the political grave back in through the Supreme Court and took away this fundamental freedom to control your own body. You in Florida have an opportunity to do something about that at the state level, and by voting, you also have something to say about whether we can prevent that from happening nationally, that we can reinstate Roe versus Wade, which will happen if we get a trifecta, if we win the House, Senate, and the presidency, which we can. Here's the thing. This country's on a knife's edge. We could either drift in the direction of fascism and authoritarianism in 3 weeks, or in 3 months, in January this coming year, we could start having the most progressive period in modern American history if we win those houses. And it's so important. Every vote counts. Let me tell you a Florida story about how many votes count. Back in 2000, our firm was doing a field operation in Southeast Florida for a wonderful candidate who was running for Congress against a Republican incumbent. And we had a good field operation. We had 15 organizers on the ground for 4 months. We had like 1,700 volunteers election day. We had knocked on doors. We did all that stuff. Did a great job. But election night, we were 570 votes short.
Mm.
Yeah. There were only about 570 precincts in the district.
Oh,
we had one more vote.
Wow.
At the end of the night, not only would our candidate have won, there would have been no Iraq war.
Yeah.
There would have been a Green New Deal. There probably wouldn't have been a Great Recession, because those same 570 votes were the shortfall of the Gore campaign that cost Al Gore the election.
Hmm.
Every vote matters, and every one of your listeners could be the difference that changes history, particularly in Florida. And, of course, we have a good shot at winning a Senate seat there, and it's very important. I mean, Debbie's one of the two places we could have, we could win a seat we don't have, Florida and Texas.
Huh.
And, you know, hopefully we'll win in all the seats we've got, but, you know, they're tight, they're tough. So we got to have the insurance of the ability to take back one of these seats, and Florida's one of them. And she's running a great campaign. Rick Scott is very unpopular.
Right.
And a fine example of why we shouldn't be electing Republicans to the Senate.
I'm glad you...
This guy, Rick Scott, is a guy who, you know, proposed, I think it was sunsetting Social Security. I mean, it's bizarre. I mean, these guys, I don't know what they're thinking, who the constituencies are, but we've got to get that out there. And the time has come to replace people like Scott with people who are good progressive senators.
What do you, the polls, like you say, the polls are close. And I'm glad you said it's so close in Florida. Make me work even harder. Yeah. I'm a precinct captain. But why is it so close? What do people like or think about Trump? I used to work in the farmers markets for Bernie many years ago, and I've had people come up to me and say, "Well, I love Trump, but I love Bernie too." And to me, that says they like authenticity. They like people who you feel like are say what they mean what they say, and stand up for their beliefs, as opposed to most politicians, which might wobble when you ask them a question. So you think that's part of the is it his decisiveness, or is it what else is there about Trump? I don't see it.
Well, most people support progressive values in America.
Yeah, you said that in your book.
Virtually every issue.
Yeah.
So part of it is just making sure we get our people out. But the other part of it is making them understand that people like Trump don't embody any of those.
Right.
At all. And that, he pretends to be a populist. He pretends to stick up for people who feel like they're being left behind. In fact, we've got to make sure that people who are being left behind get picked up by the policies we advocate. And, one of the things I think the Kamala campaign is doing a great job on getting people out, and I think it's doing a great job on, on enthusiasm and so on. I think it would do well to be more, to deliver the populist message that it does have, that it delivers periodically, regularly, but really hone in on factory towns around the Midwest and in Florida and in Arizona, and on this populist message. The fact of the matter is that, this is about Kamala representing ordinary people against a guy like Trump, who really represents the interest of himself and other billionaires.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much it. That's who he delivered for in the last time he was president. These huge tax cuts for the rich. We ought to be talking about that a lot, because that really is what separates the sheep and the goats. And that's what Bernie talks about a lot. That's why a lot of the same people who like Bernie like, or Trump like Bernie.
Exactly. I like that populist message. Let's talk about a little bit more in your book. There's one thing you talk about often is called framing. You have a good story about the Bush campaign, who wanted personal accounts. Tell us that story and some of the framing you've managed in your career.
Sure. first, all good political communication is a narrative.
Hmm.
It's really a story. And stories themselves, by the way, are the best way to communicate about any issue, not about a bunch of abstract numbers or a list or something. Pardon me. People have value frames in their minds, and that's what they use to sort data as it comes in, sort information, put it in the right place. In general, by the way, if input of information conflicts with your value frame, you're more likely to discard the data than the frame.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what we use to structure the world. People want structure. That's one of the other fundamental self-interests. They want to be able to have a handle on how the world is organized. And part of that framing of values is communicated through naming, through the names we give to things.
Yes.
So that, as you said, in the case of the Bush administration, the second Bush administration wanted to privatize Social Security. And frankly, Wall Street wanted its hands on the Social Security Trust Fund. So they proposed what they called personal accounts. And that, it sounded benign enough. People, personal accounts, it sounds nice. Pardon me. We wanted it named privatization.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted it to be about privatization, not personal accounts. And we won that naming battle, and that's one of the reasons we won the battle. Because it was about privatizing Social Security.
It still is.
That.
Yeah.
Now they want to privatize Medicare. They're doing that through the back door, a lot of them. By these Medicare Advantage programs,
yes,
this and that, and so on, making these and their proposals to make that more primary. And we got to fight that too, because, frankly, all these hedge funds taking over these services make them more expensive, and it's crazy that we don't have universal health care in the United States. Like so many countries, because it's a whole lot cheaper and everybody benefits.
That's right.
But anyway, that's a story for another discussion.
Well, there's also the inheritance versus the death tax, another framing where I think they got us on that
yeah.
one.
Yeah. Yeah, they won that one. Well, I say they won it. I mean, the inheritance tax is very popular because, obviously.
Yeah.
And by the way, and it is in effect for people who make over, what is it, $4 or $5 million, leave that kind of estate. And it should be, because we don't want an aristocracy in America, although we have one today. We
yeah.
need to get rid of it. We don't want to have it reinforced. But if you talk about inheritance tax, people are entirely in favor of it. They tried to name it the death tax. Well, nobody's for the death tax. Sounds terrible, taxing somebody when they die. And names really communicate values and communicate frames, and we have to be careful that the battles we fight, we name them properly.
Well, let's see. What have we not covered in your book? Some of the more obvious nuts and bolts. We're talking to Bob Creamer, by the way. His book is Nuts and Bolts, Formula for Progressive Electoral Success. What have we not covered? What should people know that are listening to this program that you could tell them real quickly that, I mean, we've got 15 more minutes, but what?
Let's talk about the qualities of great organizers.
Yeah.
There's a number of people, a lot of people watch your, listen to your show, I know, are engaged. Book deals with those qualities.
Yes.
And there are kind of two categories of them. One is the qualities that involve thinking like an organizer. Great organizers really understand self-interest. And they also understand the ability of somebody to get involved. You know, you got to, when you make the ask, if you're asking for money, for instance, you don't ask somebody who lives in a bungalow, small house, you know, for $1 million, right?
Yeah.
You ask them what they can do. So you figure out what somebody can do, and you ask them and put them in motion. You get great organizers understand that meaning is the most important motivator. They're giving people a sense of what they're doing is important and that they are important. Hmm. Being a great organizer is about being an agitator.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean that in the sense that you bring the concerns people have to their front of consciousness.
Yes.
I'll give an example. I was an organizer in southeast part of Chicago once years ago. We were organizing against pollution in the air in that part of the area. And I was canvassing a woman, I forget her name, Pulaski or something. And I said, she was putting a wash on her line. I said, Miss Pulaski, you know, it must be hard to keep those sheets white in this all this pollution. Well, the idea was to make her think about that pollution every time she laid down those sheets, right? That's being an agitator.
Yeah.
Bringing to mind that concern that you already have, but bringing it front and center. One of those qualities is being understanding one step at a time. You stop me if I'm going on too long.
No, you're fine.
My first supervisor, wonderful guy named Peter Martinez, he lived on the far south side of Chicago, and we had an office on the north side, and we worked late nights like a lot of campaigns did. And, about time to go, he'd say, you know what, could you drive me downtown?
Oh.
And then on your way to, I lived on the south side, but much further, much closer, much further north than he did, and I'll take the train. Okay. And I'd go downtown. He said, you know, if you just go down this expressway down the center of the city and drop me at 55th Street, when you cut over to your house, then I'd take the train from there and be real quick. Bye. And then I'd get there, and he'd say, you know, I'm only 10 minutes away. He'd drop me to my house. Now, if he'd asked me to go to the house first, I'd say, you know, I can't really do that. That's way out of the way. We teach organizers, take them to 95th Street. That's where he lives. One step at a time. Get people engaged at one level, and you'll escalate them to the next, and to the next, and to the next. And pretty soon they're doing their life fortune and sacred honor to the cause, right? But if you ask them to do that at the front end, they may not.
So you ask. Go ahead.
Repeated persuasive contact. And politics is not just about telling them once. It's the repeat, 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 repeat. That's one of the ways you make things memorable. But as I said earlier, the main way to make things memorable is to make people feel.
Give me an example.
I'm sorry?
Give me an example of making people feel. It would make them alarmed, make them proud. What do you make people feel?
Anything. I mean, if somebody is much more likely to remember something that makes them feel either angry,
yeah,
or happy, or good about, and most importantly, good about themselves.
Right.
That is what will motivate them, and will also make them remember. You go to a speech. Do you remember everything somebody says?
No.
Or how they make you feel, and that's the most important thing. And that's true of a television commercial. That's true of a conversation. So that's something to be. But the other way to get somebody to remember something big time is repeat, repeat, repeat.
Yeah.
Great organizers are about asking and listening. Great organizers are also people who understand every time you ask somebody to do something, there's a quid pro quo, and I mean that in the best way.
Hmm.
You're paying people in the currency of their own self-interest, whatever that may be. It's sometimes you hire people. That's fine.
Sure.
But other times, the self-interest you're paying is attention or excitement or they want to get out of the house or, you know, or they want contact with lots of other people because they're stuck with their, you know, kid all day or whatever. Any of those are good self-interests. We just have to tap into them. And great organizers understand it's about building relationships. This is not, you know, I walk into a room of people who are supposed to be organizers and just hear tapping on the computer. Say, you know, come on, guys. You know, get on the phone, go into somebody's living room, make an appointment, this is about relationships. And email is a good thing to remind people of things.
Yeah.
Social media is really important. But relationships are the core of great organizing. One other quick thing, quality. A lot of people say, people in our community are apathetic.
People what?
Saul Alinsky used to say to organizers, there's no such thing as apathy, only bad organizers. your job is to engage the self-interest of that person. Figure it out. Go get them engaged. And that's what's up to us over the next, not lecturing people, figuring out the self-interest that will get them motivated and motivate them.
Got it. The DJ that was on up until 9 o'clock this morning, he says he always ends his show with, say something nice to somebody. And if you start out trying to establish rapport, you'll get further than if you start lecturing them. And I agree with him. How would you approach, if you were on the front porch of a likely Trump voter, how would you approach them? Or did you have a question, Alvaro?
I did, but I want to hear this first.
Okay, so how would you approach a guy who's a likely Trump voter? Anything you could do to change his mind?
In an election context, first off, if he is an absolute dyed-in-the-wool Trump voter, I would say, thank you very much for your time. Move to the next door.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you're not going to convince. But if he is a potential persuadable, that is, if there's any crack in the, you know, you ask him, what is it you like about the Trump stuff?
Uh-huh.
Or whatever, what are the things that are really matter to you? And then try and find a way in that engages their self-interest by connecting that self-interest with our candidate. But it's not by lecturing them about the things that matter to you. It's by asking them first and beginning to understand what matters to them and then connecting that interest in what we are doing. I mean, what our candidate is. So that's the key. I mean, it depends on what they have to say, you know, and if they feel like government's out of control or out of their reach or whatever, it's not with them. Say, you know, don't you agree that it's a crazy thing when all these billionaires really run things?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, because that's what they'll say.
Yeah.
And, you know, Trump's been, got a silver spoon in his mouth. You know, this guy has been a billionaire or so, or a millionaire or whatever, except he lost a lot of money. One of the things, by the way, we want to communicate in a macro level is that Trump is a loser. Not that he's a winner at all, that he's a loser,
mm-hmm.
and that he's weak. One of the things a lot of men like about Trump is he seems to be strong,
mm-hmm.
pretends to be strong. He's not. Think about it. I mean, this is the guy who's one of the most insecure people alive.
Yeah.
I mean, he's constantly talking about himself. Who's strong talks about themselves all the time?
Well, not only that, he's a chicken. He won't debate. He won't do it.
Yeah.
He's a coward. Men don't like that.
Weak and increasingly unmoored. You know, this is a guy who has been losing it, you know?
Yeah.
And that, too. We got to portray him that way and say it over and over.
Say it. You're right.
He's a weak loser. And because people like winners. They like to be with a winner. And a lot of folks like strength in their leaders, absolutely. One of the qualities of great leadership that we communicate to make people feel good about themselves in their presence is, of course, strong, effective leadership that he'll deliver for us. But the idea, of course, is that the leader helps keep us safe, and it leads us into success. I mean, this is a guy who constantly failed in business, whose great strength in life is being a con man. That's his big skill. And, you know, you want a con man as president, elect Donald Trump again.
We're talking to Bob Creamer. His new book is called Nuts and Bolts, The Formula for Progressive Electoral Success. Alvaro, you had a question.
Yes. I was impacted by something Mr. Creamer said at the beginning, and related to his activity as a student years back. I think I want to make two points. One, that some things are changing or have changed a lot, and some things stay the same. As it relates to student activism, we took over at one point the Board of Governors meeting. They were meeting at Rutgers University. We took over the board meeting. And we made our points, and we got them to react positively to some of the arguments that we were raising, including South Africa, getting out of South Africa, of divesting from South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
We received no repercussions. Today, students at USF had a gathering to protest U.S. involvement in support for the genocide in Gaza.
Right.
And immediately the university brought in police and entities of the sort from six different jurisdictions, beat up. Attacked the students, including with very dangerous weaponry. They, for instance, I was there, and not more than 10 feet away from me, a projectile hit a tree that burst into flames. Immediately, burst into flames.
Jeez.
So they're doing this with kids, students, 18, 20 years old, who had only gathered peacefully to express their concerns about what was happening there. So times have changed, I think, tremendously. I'm not saying that things of the sort did not happen in the past, but too many more of the time the entities in charge, the universities, were a little more lenient. So I have other things that we also had a building that the university gave us to run summer programs, and at the end of the summer program, like Mr. Creamer said, we too said, no, we're not giving the building back, you know, and we held it for a long time. So that's in things that changed. Things that stay the same, criticism of the Democratic Party and the Republicans too. I mean, I don't know that much about them, but what I have seen about the Democratic Party is they go to sleep, they turn hostile to the community, to the people, and they wake up and become our greatest friends only 3 or 4 months before the election. Uh-huh. You know,
so I've heard that from the black community, of course. Yeah,
that's essentially what I wanted to say.
Yeah, what about
no
that?
No doubt, we have to. The Democrats have to, which includes, you know, a lot of folks from the black and Hispanic communities have to deliver for ordinary people. That's why a populist frame is very important. But between elections, we got to keep it on. Now, I will say, the most productive, progressive period in recent history was under Joe Biden in the first 2 years of administration when we had the House, Senate, and presidency, and did a lot for, you know, moving things in the right direction. But, you know, lots of people are hurting in America, and we've got to be talking about delivering for those people and delivering in a context where we identify the targets, the causes of the problem. That's why Kamala going after price gouging is so popular.
Great.
Because these big corporations end up raising prices because there are monopoly elements in the economy that allow them to, and they will if they can. And we got to stop them. That's why. And the only way to stop them is not the market. It won't do that. It's got to be the government. It's got to be all of us together saying, nope, the rules of the game are such you can't do that.
Yes.
But, you know, I will say, electing good public officials matter. Let me give you a quick story on that one. So Northwestern University, and where I live, is in Evanston, Illinois, which is right north of Chicago. We have a very progressive mayor who runs the police force. And I got a call from a Palestinian friend, said, worried if there was a protest on the campus, same issue. And word is that they're going to bring the police in and rouse these folks. They were doing a peaceful protest. And pretty soon the mayor calls us. My wife is the congressman, you know, who's Jewish. He's Jewish. And said, you know, they're going to rouse these people for being nonviolent protest. You know, that's, I don't think that's right. You said, we said, no. So he called the president of the university and said, you know, you're not going to get Evanston police to help.
Great.
And they didn't have enough troops to do it by themselves. So they ended up negotiating a reasonable settlement in terms of the kind of structure of the protest went for it. Having a great public official really mattered in that context.
Wow.
We've got to elect people who stand up for our values, our democratic values. And on the Gaza front, and I don't want to end with this because it's, you know, I hope that that policies of Kamala's camp election, I mean Kamala's administration, will do more to pressure this outrageous dictator Netanyahu into ending the apartheid in South Africa.
I hope
and
so.
I'm a, you know, I say my wife's Jewish. I'm part Israel. Jewish.
Israel, yeah.
Yeah, and I say, well, there you go. I made a mistake. It wasn't South Africa, it was Israel. And got to be two states where two people can live in peace together, where they have Palestinian self-determination, where everybody has security. And the notion that that's not the case is a tragedy and a violation of our democratic principles. So we got to do that, and America can play a big role in doing that. And I think, by the way, has played a big role in trying to restrain the left to their own devices. This right-wing cabinet in Israel would just, you know, blow the place up, and they want to run all the Palestinians out. I mean, it's just simple as that, in my judgment. But we got to do a lot more, in my view, as well.
Well, thank you, Bob. This has been a great conversation. I appreciate the new book you've written, Nuts and Bolts, The Formula for Progressive Electoral Success, Bob Creamer, C-R-E-A-M-E-R. You can find his book online and in all the bookstores. And he's a longtime organizer, 55 years. And you're the kind of guy we need on our side, and I really appreciate it. And I really appreciate it. And stay